Hi, everybody. This is Randy Weingarten again, and this is, if it's Tuesday night, it's Tuesday nights with the AFT. And, you know, as we have lots and lots of guests on tonight because we have the PTA who's been co-sponsoring this hour with us, and we have an amazing lineup who I'm going to introduce in a minute. But this is part of our Tuesday night series of the AFT and our activist members. And tonight we have lots of parents and lots of people who are really, really concerned about education. Now, ultimately, as everybody knows, the COVID-19 pandemic has upended, I would say, virtually all of our lives. And ultimately, no more than the people who have their families, of the people who have died. There's over 10,000 people who have died in the United States from COVID. We now have the largest number of people who have COVID around the world. And then, of course, there's our frontline and healthcare and other frontline workers who are actually risking their own lives and risking sickness themselves, grocery workers, transit workers, respiratory therapists, nurses, and others, often without the protective equipment they need, who are out there helping us. Then there's, of course, all the educators who are attempting to make sure that kids are engaged and frankly, being part of the public health infrastructure, keeping the social distancing done, as well as trying to engage kids instructionally. And then, of course, there are all the grab-and-go, the people who are doing grab-and-go and doing all the other things that are helping kids eat. And then, of course, there are all the parents who have all of a sudden become instructors, when they had been for years and years and years having teachers being instructors. And then, of course, we have governors and mayors who are heroically trying to manage this crisis with the help of, frankly, those in Congress that passed the CARES Act 1, 2, and 3, or the COVID Act 1, 2, and 3 in the CARES Act. And then there's a lot of other things that are going on. And so what we're trying to do today is we really want to focus on education. I often, as many of you know, I keep saying that as a union, we've been focused on three things. Number one, keeping the health and safety and well-being of our communities foremost in our minds. That's part of the reason why we, by early March, said we have to close schools because of knowing what the transmission lines were. Second, we have to focus like a laser on the health and safety of the people who are helping us, those frontline workers I mentioned before. And that's why today the AFT started a whole big commercial ads on how we help nurses and others get the protective equipment they need. And frankly, we are actually trying to buy that protective equipment ourselves to help those help our members and others. And third, we have to protect against all the huge economic impacts of this short and long term, not just for Wall Street or industry. Obviously, industry is important, but for regular workers and regular families, many of whom people who have been unemployed, many of people who have lost loved ones. We have to make sure state and local governments have the funding they need so that schools thrive next year. There's a lot of things that we have to do. But frankly, it's really good news that in places, hotspots like New York, like Washington State, you're starting to see a flattening of the curve and the social distancing is working. Governor Cuomo said a couple of days ago that the worst may be over. Governors are starting to work together to try to figure out what combination of testing and tracing and isolation and quarantine are necessary in order to try to open things up again in the absence of a vaccine. So there's a lot of people who are trying to work together. I'm not going to be political tonight about what the president is doing or not doing, and I was very grateful that we had the Surgeon General on last week, Dr. Jerome Adams. But right now, for the rest of this hour,
We're going to talk to parents and to educators about how we find ways to deal with the circumstances that we are in and the circumstances that we'll probably be in for at least the next 6 weeks and maybe until the end of the school year. Because parents and educators together, we got to find ways to deal with the anxiety and the trauma that we're facing than that our students are facing. We got to find ways to do the work-home balance and all of that. And we have to figure out how to help our kids engage as we're building the plane and flying it at the same time. We all knew that that remote learning or virtual learning was not the best kind of learning in the first place. You know, it's part of the reason that K-12 Inc. and others have not succeeded, and that we need bricks and mortar schools because we know we need that kind of relationship building and that kind of connection that we have together. But in this pandemic, we're forced to do something completely different than we've done before. And so with the help of the Carnegie Foundation and the Carnegie Corporation that is helping to sponsor tonight's town hall, we joined forces with the PTA, and we have Nathan Monell, the executive director of the National PTA, who is here right after me. We've joined forces with mental health experts and with well-being experts, like people like Dr. Pam Cantor, the founder and senior science advisor for Turnaround for Children, who I've known for an eternity and who has really helped me learn a lot about well-being. We had people like Dr. Arthur Evans, the CEO of the American Psychological Association, and we have a parent, Antoinette Brown, and an educator, Jim Arry, who will highlight some of the practices they've deployed during this period of time to support students. So I want to end just on a high point. We are going to get through this. Hopefully we'll get through this with most of our loved ones being well, with those who have been sick getting better. We pray for and mourn the people who have lost their lives, but we also stay connected with all of us who are fighting together to make this work. The pandemic is affecting almost everyone's lives, but you see the kind of heroic work like Yolanda Fisher, one of our members who's on the cover of Time magazine this week. She's a cafeteria worker in Dallas who has been delivering meals to families. That's part of what so many of us on this phone are doing, whether it's for our own families, whether it's for children in our virtual classrooms, whether it's all the things we're trying to do to hold things together, caring, fighting, showing up. Today is about trying to figure out what those best practices are, answering your questions, press zero to get in the queue in terms of the questions, and now it's my pleasure to ask Nathan Monell, the executive director of the National PTA. Thank you.
Thank you, Randy, and thank you, AFT, for inviting National PTA to be part of this teletown hall. I also want to add my thanks to the Carnegie Corporation of New York for funding this great opportunity to bring parents and teachers together. As Randy mentioned, students are at the heart of our collective work, and we know that students can only be supported through this difficult time if the adults in their lives are supported as well. At National PTA, we believe that parents and teachers are natural allies, and now in this time of crisis, this partnership is more important than ever. We're pleased to participate in this town hall because we know that many families and teachers are feeling totally overwhelmed right now as they try to figure out how to support our children and one another during this crisis. PTA's utmost priority during this time is the health and safety of all of our members, all of our students, our educators, our staff, and our families. Our association is also committed to making sure that our communities have what they need during this challenging time. We want all of you who are on the phone, parents and teachers alike, to know that PTA is here for you. We're advocating for our nation's families and schools and working to support families and educators as well as to try to help answer questions that people might have. we did a survey recently of PTA leaders across the country, and in conversation with many of you, we've heard about your concerns. They're loud and clear about the challenges you're experiencing in ensuring your own and your children's social, emotional well-being during this crisis. You know, my experience with this is not theoretical. As a parent to two teenagers, one who has struggled with mental health issues, I know this firsthand. Being away from regular routine and being isolated from friends has exacerbated my son's challenges and many other students as well. And as parents, we don't always know what to do. It's not always clear to us. The schools we're in right now just came off spring break, and today they started distance learning. So those of you who are navigating that world, we're joining along with you. So while there's certainly stress in our household right now, as I try to keep my kids learning and engaged and feeling positive, all the while with two teleworking parents, I know that in spite of all this, we are very fortunate. We have families and students in our country who are experiencing significant loss, either having lost family members to this disease or having to be separated from their loved ones to protect their health. And this is especially true for our essential workers that Randy mentioned, many whom are on the phone lines tonight. We thank you for your service and know these times are especially difficult for you and your families. We also have families and students who've lost income or cannot access the essentials of health care and nutritious meals. We have families whose plans with their children are indefinitely on hold, missing graduation ceremonies with their seniors, trying to figure out their summer plans, being able to see friends again in person. And it's challenging. We can look all around us and see uncertainty and loss. But we know that we are resilient and the pandemic will eventually pass and we'll still be here standing. In the meantime, we're left needing strategies to cope with our stress and whatever that stress might be like for you. So I'm confident that our incredible panel of speakers will be able to help us tonight as we all look for ways to feel supported and connected during this challenging time. And with that, I turn it back to Randy to introduce our first speaker.
Thank you, Nathan, and thank you for joining us, and thank you for partnering with us on this. You're so right about parents and teachers really are that key partnership together, and now more than ever. And I also just want to, one more time, thank Carnegie for helping the Carnegie Corporation and Foundation for helping make this particular town hall happen. These are not inexpensive, and the fact that they were able to fund this for us was really, really awesome. So thank you, Carnegie. So we have four speakers on our panel, and the first is Pam Cantor, who is a doctor, who will discuss the neurobiology of stress and trauma in light of the pandemic and offer the three R's, relationships, routines, and resilience, in terms of what to do. Now, Pam has practiced child and adult and adolescent psychiatry for nearly two decades, specializing in trauma. And I met Pam during both of our work in the aftermath of the impact of the 9/11 attacks. And so she is a recognized expert, and I just love her to pieces. And instead of me saying more about Pam, you'll all fall in love with her after she speaks. So Pam Cantor, and as Pam starts, I just want to make sure I remind people, Dr. Pam Cantor, that if you have a question, press 0 to get on the question queue. And even if we don't get everybody's question publicly during this hour, we will make sure between the PTA and AFT that we get all of your questions answered and respond to all of your questions over the course of the next few days. Pam.
Thank you, Randy. Thank you so much. I want to tell the audience that if you follow us on Twitter at Turnaround or have access to our website, turnaroundusa.org/coronavirus, you are actually going to be able to track visuals that go along with the talk I'm about to give or access them after the talk. My organization, Turnaround for Children, as Randy said, was founded in the aftermath of 9/11. It was founded on one core insight, and that is that adversity doesn't just happen to children. It happens inside their bodies through the biologic mechanism of stress. Today, we work with leaders and teachers across the country, providing knowledge and tools to equip educators to respond to the many adversities in children's lives and in the lives of the adults working with them every day. We've reached 250,000 or more students and many more through our field leadership, our 180 podcast, our presentations and videos, all of it putting powerful knowledge and tools about trauma and stress and learning and healthy development in the hands of all the adults in all of the settings in which children grow and learn. Unlike 9/11 or the financial crisis of 2008 or adversities like poverty, this pandemic is not happening to some of us. It's happening to all of us. And the biology of this virus is such that disruptions will continue to be with us even after schools reopen. We're going to know losses. We will be anxious about catching the disease or giving it to someone else. And we're going to be watching the impact on our country each day. And all of this means we're going to be managing high levels of stress, the stress of others, our families, our students, and our friends. Here is what we do know about living with high levels of stress. There are two hormonal systems in the body that regulate stress. And when we experience it, cortisol is released through our brains and bodies, and it produces that familiar feeling of fight, flight, and freeze. It's intense when it happens. But if the stress is mild or tolerable, it's adaptive. It makes us alert and sharp and helps us prepare, like for a test or a performance. This is our limbic system at work: attention, concentration, focus, memory. But when children have persistently high levels of stress and that stress is not buffered by the presence of a trusted and calm adult, something else can happen. A child can get locked in that fight or flight feeling and it just won't let up. This is the condition we call toxic stress. Cortisol can do a lot of damage to the structures of the limbic system, the prefrontal cortex, the hippocampus, the amygdala, structures that regulate focus and attention, house memory, and control emotion. This is what we mean when we say that stress can get under the skin and affect our emotions, our thinking, and our learning. But that's not the end of the story. There's a big upside when we turn to another hormone, the hormone oxytocin. This is the hormonal system that produces feelings of trust, love, attachment, and safety, and that's not all. Oxytocin hits the same structures in the brain as cortisol, but oxytocin is the more powerful hormone because it can literally protect children at the cellular level from the damaging effects of cortisol. Relationships that are strong and positive cause the release of oxytocin, and this not only helps children manage stress, it offsets the damaging effects of cortisol, and it produces resilience to future stress. The human relationship and oxytocin are the most powerful examples we have of positive context. But I bet you can tell where I'm going, because today we have a serious paradox, the COVID paradox. Because in order to provide the greatest sense of physical safety to ourselves, we are disrupting the very things we need in order to be emotionally safe. These are the connections we all need to feel safe, to cope with stress, to manage fear, to surmount this crisis. The need for physical distancing in order to be safe physically and the need for social belonging for our emotional safety and resilience are contradictory requirements, and yet both are necessary. And all of the actions we're taking today are disrupting the communities in our lives that provide that belonging. our families, our schools, our sports, and churches. So how was 9/11 different? COVID is often compared to 9/11, but 9/11 was very different. It was one horrible day for this country. And COVID-19 is a global contagion that has already been with us for weeks and will likely be with us for many months to come. What's most different about COVID are the uncertainties, especially about the timeline. Is this the new normal? Will there be a next normal? Or are there more changes to come? I don't know about you, but how many times have you been asked a question that begins with the words, how long? The social isolation is also different because today we can't be with the people we're close to, teachers, friends, sometimes even our own children, and all of our routines are disrupted. The economy is damaged with lost jobs, reduced retirement funds, and food and housing insecurity. After 9/11, I was asked to help lead a study on the effects of 9/11 on New York City's public school children. And the finding that surprised all of us at the time was that the most startling effects on children were not in the Ground Zero schools. They were in the children and schools and communities of deepest poverty. I'll never forget walking in to an elementary school in the South Bronx where a class had been asked to draw a drawing on what 9/11 meant to them. And a little boy who was about 6 years old named Thomas showed me his picture. And there were two boxes in the background with smoke coming out. But in the foreground were two stick figure boys with guns pointed at each other. For Thomas, he was afraid of walking to school in the morning. Stress for children is local. That's what activates the stress mechanisms that I've been talking about. And for many children, that stress is in their homes. Here's what we know. A stressed brain is often shut down. It will struggle to focus and concentrate. And a stressed person is easily triggered. The neurobiology of this is explained by the interplay between cortisol and oxytocin. There's been a false choice in education between the things we need to do on the social and emotional front and the pursuit of academic excellence, as if the social and emotional stuff is the soft stuff. But here's the kicker. The way our brains are wired, it is our emotions that drive the development of our cognitive and learning skills. Our emotions engage us or shut us down. This is what the limbic system of the brain does. And today we have no choice. If we don't open the mind by reducing stress, we won't see the ability to focus, concentrate, engage, and we won't build the resilience we need. The path to a calm classroom is a calm brain. The path to learning is a calm brain. And the path to both of these, whether it is in our homes now or when our kids reenter schools, is to prioritize three things: relationships, routines, and resilience, the three R's. What we mean when we talk about relationships is about that kind of connection, the connection that releases oxytocin. Connect virtually with students, individually or through advisories. Use a staff huddle and meet with your teachers in the early morning for maybe 15 minutes to try to maintain a professional community. Do check-ins between teachers and families using guided questions on the family's well-being, schoolwork, or how parents and kids are doing. And engage other school staff like social workers and coaches for mentoring and tutoring. And one of the most important things at home is to do things together like cooking and cleaning and introducing new and important routines. Routines is our next priority. Set up predictable routines. The brain is a prediction machine. It loves order. Set up a routine planner and put posters up with a daily schedule and celebrate successes. Set up regular times for lessons and reading and storytelling. and engage family members in virtual lessons so they can be done together. Proactively have family meetings. Don't avoid talking about COVID or about loss. Eat meals together. Take care of yourself. Did you know that rhythmic things like exercise calm the brain? Learn a reflective practice like meditation or journaling. And finally, resilience. Resilience is not something you have or you don't. It's not a trait. It can be built like a muscle, and the key to resilience is regulation. So limit media, provide resources and tools to teachers on stress. Take a look at a wonderful video series that we produced with Edutopia called How Learning Happens, which is now available, 23 videos to support practice. And to have a specific opportunity to co-regulate with kids, there's a really simple practice called the 2x10. Set up 2 minutes of conversation for 10 straight days with a child who's struggling about anything they want to talk about, and watch what happens to that child's ability to regulate when you do that. And don't forget to create things that you can look forward to, because hope is important here and the belief that we will get out of this. One thing that's true in every single story that any of us has ever read about a person who has successfully surmounted adversity, there was always the presence of a person or people who made that possible. It wasn't an accident. Admiral Stockdale captured this in his Stockdale Paradox. He said he survived a Vietnamese prison camp by facing the facts, never rationalizing, and never losing the belief that he would survive through the connection to others. Thank you all very much for letting me participate in this.
Thank you very much, Dr. Cantor, for your leadership, for your insightful comments and suggestions. I know we're all taking notes as we listen. It's my honor to introduce our second expert guest speaker tonight, my colleague and friend of PTA, Dr. Arthur Evans. Dr. Evans is the CEO of the American Psychological Association, which you all know to be the leading scientific and professional organization representing psychology in the United States with 121,000 members. If you follow Dr. Evans' career, you know that he is focused on employing science and research, community activism, spirituality, traditional clinical care, policy, and cross-system collaboration to change the status quo, using a data-driven population health approach to improve outcomes for people and to increase system efficiency. His work has helped prevent behavioral health challenges among children and adults and intervened in thoughtful and impactful ways with those who are at high risk or in high need. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Arthur Evans to the phone line.
Thank you. Thank you for the introduction, and thank all of you who are on the call tonight. So I was asked to talk about the caregivers and those who take care of children, and to talk about their mental health and what they can do to improve their mental health and address mental health concerns. So I'm going to talk about two things. The first is, why is addressing your mental health important? And then secondly, to talk about some of the things that you can do to take ownership over your own mental health. And what I want to really stress is that your mental health is something that you have some control over, and that there are things that you can do to improve your mental health, and there are things that you can do to make sure that you are mitigating against stressors and other things that might negatively impact on your mental health. And so I want to talk about that. And I want to base all of my comments on the latest research and science in many of these areas. So let me start with just analogy. I do a lot of traveling, and before you ever take off on a flight, the first thing you do is you go through the safety procedures. And one of them is that if there is a loss of cabin pressure, a mask will drop down, and you need to put that mask on to make sure that you get enough oxygen. But one of the things that they say consistently is that you should put your mask on first before you try to help someone else. And as parents, I want you to keep that in mind as I talk about this, because as parents, and I am a parent, it is the most important thing that we do. And it's where we put all of our energy. And sometimes we can get things out of whack where we're not taking care of ourselves. And what is really clear is that how well our children do depends a lot on how well we are doing. And in fact, if you look at in the aftermath of any crisis or traumatic event, one of the best predictors of how a child is going to be doing and handling that event is how well their parent is doing. So that's the first thing that I want to tell you in terms of why it's important for you to manage your mental health. The second thing is that our mental health status has a significant impact on our decision-making and our functioning in the various roles we have as parents, as employers, or employees. And you have to be aware that your mental health status is very important in terms of your ability to make good decisions. Let me give you an example. We know from research that if you are very angry, and clearly this is a situation that we find ourselves in, which people can get quite angry about what's happening, but one of the things that happens is that people are engage in much riskier behavior when they are angry. Conversely, when people are fearful and anxious, their decision making around risk tends to be exacerbated or exaggerated, and so people are overly risk averse in that situation. The point is that our emotional state does have an ability on our have an impact on our ability to process information and to make good decisions for ourselves and for our families. And then the third thing that I would say in terms of why it's important for us to focus on our mental health is that our mental health has a direct impact on our physical health. And you heard Dr. Cantor talk about some of the research in that area, so I won't go into that. But our physical, our mental health has a direct bearing on our physical health, and so we want to make sure that if we want to remain healthy overall, that we think about our mental health in that context. So let me talk then about some of the things that you can do based on the research that are really important for maintaining and ensuring that you have the best psychological health. The first is, and this is, in my view, the most important factor, and Dr. Cantor also mentioned this, it is social connectedness. We have literally hundreds of studies that show that social support, the idea, the people that we have in our lives that can be supportive to us and can help us, that the amount of social support that you have is directly related to our physical health, our mental health, and generally how we do in life. And we have literally hundreds of studies going back decades showing that relationship. And so it's really important for us to maintain that connectedness. And the problem or challenge that we have now is that we're being told to socially distance, and I would reframe that and say what we're really trying to do is be physically distant, but we want to stay socially connected. And so we have to make a concerted effort to overcome that physical distance and keep those social connections. And we should do that in all kinds of ways. I mean, you have to do that through technology primarily. I would strongly suggest doing things like FaceTime calls instead of just voice calls, because that helps us psychologically connect better to the person. Many people have more time now, and so you can call some of those friends. You know, all of us have those friends that we have not talked to for many years sometimes or months. Now's the time to reach out to them and check out how you feel when you make that connection. And again, I would encourage that to be FaceTime. Many religious organizations, even though people can't gather physically, are doing their services online. If you get a lot of of strength and support from your religious community, I would encourage you to do that as well, whether it's your church or masjid or synagogue or whatever your religion is. If that's important to you, make an extra effort to connect. So the first point is let's make sure that we're doing everything we can to stay socially connected. Use this as an opportunity to maybe make connections that you have missed over the years. Secondly, limit your media and social media consumption. We have a growing body of research that is showing that especially having a lot of media consumption is negatively affected with our mental health, and that one of the ways to manage that is to really limit the amount of media that we're taking in. If you have in the background running all day news about the pandemic, it is going to affect you. And so you want to be conscious about those kinds of things, maybe limit how much you're going to watch to an hour a day or whatever you believe you need. Use trusted sources and limit your information to trusted sources. And just make sure that you're really conscious of how much you are consuming and you're not being very passive in sort of just allowing that information to kind of wash over you as it is playing in the background. Same thing with social media. Social media can be very harmful in terms of a lot of the information that people are putting out. The third thing is to attend to your physical health. Very important, sleep, eat, exercise turn out to have a major impact on our mental health. Cognitive reframing, something that we do when we work with people clinically is to help people rethink their thoughts. If you notice that you're having a lot of negative thoughts, you might want to step back and examine those. There's a tendency for us to catastrophize when we're in these kinds of situations. We play scenarios out to the worst possible end. And so one of the tricks that you can employ is to step back, examine those thoughts, and think about another way of looking at the same situation with a different kind of outcome. Being very intentional about engaging in pleasurable activities. Another thing that we do when we work with people, because one of the things that can happen, particularly when you're in these kinds of situations, is that you can get so focused on trying to solve all of the problems and challenges that you have that you stop engaging in those things that you like to do. And one of the ways that we work with people is to help them identify those things that are pleasurable and integrate them back into their lives. Much more challenging now, but it's the kind of thing that it is worth the effort for you to think through as you're thinking about how you're going to better cope with this situation. Take the long view. You don't have to figure out everything today. You don't have to have all of your children's classes organized and all of their notebooks. This is going to be, unfortunately, a marathon that we're running. And you don't have to sprint. You have to jog. That's the way you finish a marathon. And so pace yourself out. Don't feel like you have to have everything perfect and that you give yourself enough time to really address the various things in your life. And then finally, it's important to recognize that when you have a need for professional help, to reach out and get that help. One of the things that's happening now is something called telehealth, which means that clinicians are able to see you through through video chats or through even telephone calls. It was one of the things that we fought very strongly for because in certain rural parts of the country, people don't always have the bandwidth to do the video chatting. And so we were successful as a mental health community in getting that provision in some of the various insurance programs. So reach out to your insurance company. If you're employed, you probably have an employee assistance program. That's another place where you can get some help. You can go to our website, which is apa.org, for American Psychological Association.org, and there is a locator there where you can go to your state, and it will take you to your state psychological association, and you can look up psychologists in your community. So those are some ways, but it's really important to understand that sometimes, despite all the things that we do, we still need that professional help. That's a great thing. Reach out, get telehealth, and it's a way of helping you to address those stressors and other challenges you might have. The one thing that I'll end with is that there are a diversity of approaches, and people live in a lot of different places, so there is no one set of things that will work for everyone. If you live in an urban community in a high rise, it's going to be different than someone who lives on a farm in a very sparsely populated community. And so everything that we're talking about tonight really has to be adjusted in that way. And the final thing that I will say is this, that we are, as people, very resilient. Dr. Kanter also spoke about that. We will get through this. We will adapt to the new realities that we have. And so if there's anything that you can do to help keep that perspective, it'll go a long way in helping you to remain calm, to remain as relaxed as one can, and really helping you to get through not only the challenges that we have now, but those that we have that are coming up. So with that, I'm going to stop and look forward to hearing people's questions.
Thank you, Dr. Evans. And I want to just make sure we've been ferociously emailing each other, because I want us to go to 7 instead of doing 5:45 to 6:45, because we want to really make sure we have a good 15 minutes of questions. And it was so important what you and Dr. Kanter said: relationships, resilience, routines. It's not social distancing, it's physical distancing, where we have to be socially connected. You gave your APA.org website. I know that Dr. Kanter gave a website, but, you know, I'm like a Twitter freak these days. So Dr. Kanter's Twitter was @turnaround, T-U-R-N-A-R-O-U-N-D. Nathan's Twitter is National PTA, ampersand, and National, NATIONAL PTA. And mine is R. Weingarten, R-W-E-I-N-G-A-R-T-E-N. And with that, I want to actually introduce Jim R.A., who is a social studies teacher, 29-year social studies teacher from Elk Grove Village, and a union leader. And his association has over, he represents over 880 school teachers. And in his spare time, not that he has any, he serves as an AFT national trainer for our trauma-informed practice course. And so without further ado, because there's a bunch of resources that Nathan and I also want to give people so that you have them. But without further ado, I just really want to introduce Jim to say a few words, and then Nathan's going to introduce one of our parent leaders, and then we're going to go for questions. Jim.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I was asked to talk about how teachers are addressing student and our own social-emotional well-being. We are currently in week 3 of our remote learning plan. And our primary focus of student engagement is to support the social-emotional well-being of our students. Fortunately, this transition to remote learning has been made manageable because of a team philosophy that takes a whole child trauma-sensitive approach that embeds SEL right into the curriculum. So we use an integrated focus with literacy instruction providing the vehicle for achieving our SEL goals. I have an outstanding team representing the English Language Fine Arts is Kristen Lesniak, Physical Education is Samir Chaudhry. We have Educational Support Personnel, Shirley Flickinger, who also has a counseling degree, and then myself in Social Studies with a civic education focus. So collectively, we've fused all three of these disciplines into an integrated, interdisciplinary experiential learning approach. In many ways, we were built to transition into remote learning with an SEL focus. So all the tools and strategies I'll be sharing with you today have been used in some form during the school year and now are being employed in the remote learning situation. So here we go. I'm going to give you a list of the things that we're doing. The first thing that our team does is we use a two-way messaging system called Remind. And so what we do here is we provide our kids with updates, reminders, or tasks to complete prior to us actually meeting. So, for example, we met yesterday, and prior to our Zoom meeting, we had our students check, do a zone check-in. Zones, this would be a second strategy we use, is a modified version from Leah Kuyper's Zones of Regulation, where students use their phones to access a barcode that provides the team with immediate emotional state of our students before we even engage them. And then there's a series of questions that we ask: where would you like to be, what do you need, and how can you help yourself to get where you'd like to be? This idea of building resilience, which you've heard here today. And then other questions that we ask: what do you want us to know and how can we help you? So we want our students to be curious about their emotions. Emotions are normal. They inform us about ourselves and the environment. So we believe in using this information as data to inform and help guide both us and the student. The third thing that we use are Google Docs. We use these this technique at the end of the week to debrief our students. How did it go this week? Where did you spend your time? What insights have you gained? What challenges have you overcome this week? So the information gleaned from the debrief can then be used by the team to follow up. So last week, one of my students, Mariana, said she's making cheesecakes and that she may have found her passion in life. So I took that, emailed her back with a career resource on cooking, which I didn't know she enjoyed, and then I sent her Bernice Green's Yum Yum Coffee Cake recipe. You know, it's these small gestures. Hopefully they add up to big gestures. And then the fourth thing, we use the email. As in Mariana's case, I can personalize the one-to-one response with a follow-up email. So we use email also to develop learning plans for individual students who need to raise their grades or who want to complete enrichment programs. Then, of course, the face-to-face. The brick and mortar is not there, but we use Zoom. So we meet once a week during a scheduled time, and the check-in with the entire program. So we have three sections, 70 students, and all four of the teachers orchestrate the madness. So our job is to share information, provide updates, respond to questions, play games. Yesterday we did a wall sit. Next week we have a rap contest. So we're trying to make it fun, build a routine, build consistency, build community, but more importantly, just let our kids know we love them. One of my students wrote back yesterday to us after the session and said, you guys are the glue that keeps us together. And, you know, I think after this year we'll always be family, because we have experienced this time together. Just wanted to tell you guys the change in our lives. Thanks. You know, pretty cool to get that type of feedback from kids. And then, of course, we use Schoology, an online learning platform that stores all of our course content in easy-to-navigate folders. So English has short stories, reaction to video documentaries. PE has daily workouts plus health and nutrition. We do one-on-one counseling. Then social studies provides questions on discussion boards on topics ranging from resiliency to thriving. We also have a mindfulness folder where we do breathing, mindfulness work, and meditations focused on leadership development through Erica Brown's Take Your Soul to Work. And then the final piece is volunteer opportunities, whether it's developing PSAs for anti-vaping, COVID-19 connections, writing personal notes to troops. We're working on library cards for kids who live in unincorporated areas. In fact, when I get off of this call, the library board's voting on whether to give them access. And then we do Kiva and crowdsourcing. So we really focus on giving our kids a sense of control and belief. They can make a difference in the world. They're capable of being that change they want to see. We encourage our kids to dream and imagine by taking love and action, a term coined by Dr. Jin Wright in his work on the future of healing. And we use that same concept, and we try to apply that to our teachers. You know, the well-being of the adult, as you heard, is a critical factor in supporting young people's well-being. So I'm out of time, but perhaps during the Q&A portion, I can provide some examples of how we're addressing the well-being of our team and our members and any additional questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jim, for sharing those strategies with us. We can hear a lot of enthusiasm in your voice and can understand why your students feel cared for and loved by you. You're a great example of the teachers that we value all across the country. I'm also pleased to introduce to you a PTA leader who's been championing a variety of innovative efforts to support her community during this challenging time. Antoinette Brown is the president of Gorman Crossing Elementary School PTA, located nearby here in Laurel, Maryland. They've been one of the participating schools in National PTA's Schools of Excellence program, which really stretches them to grow. And Antoinette is also the mother of two, a third grader and a fourth grader. She's been involved with PTA for 3 years and is passionate about serving her community. She's going to share with us some of what she's doing to reduce stress in her community. Please join me in welcoming Antoinette.
Thank you for having me on. Gorman Crossing Elementary School PTA is a close-knit community. COVID-19 was unexpected, and it was something none of us had experienced. We went from having several activities a month to canceling all events and following a mandated stay-at-home order. Along with my executive board, we signed up for a job that doesn't close. So to find ways to increase socialization within our school community and ensure that they know that life still exists outside of your home, just in a different way, we moved to a completely virtual platform. Video calls were introduced to help children stay connected with their peers and to help prevent feelings of loneliness and isolation. In addition to the video calls by grade level for all grades, weekly story times for our kindergarten, first, second, and third grades were formed. This week we have a guest speaker reading to those grades on Wednesday. While our school staff was busy preparing for online learning, our students were creating thank you collages for the staff and taking photos for each day of virtual spirit weeks, which they loved. Our teachers responded right back with photos and videos to say hi to our students, share tips on how to manage our new normal, and encourage our community to keep reading and get outside to exercise. Other ways we were bridging a gap between the home and school are the PTA staff provide educational resources to our students. Our school counselors have virtual office hours. The PTA and ESL teachers are working together to identify community members who can provide translation assistance to help ESL families in preparation for online learning. This Wednesday, to do something different, we're hosting Cooking with Shalisa, where the kids will make homemade muffins, and she will also share a video on how to make homemade pizza. On Friday, we have scientist Gregory May coming, who's also a former Ringling Brothers circus performer, who's hosting a virtual circus science show for us. Our next PTA meeting, we have emergency medicine physician Dr. Diana Lake, who spends countless hours on the front line as our guest speaker. And one of our fellow PTA members at Bushy Park Elementary School shared the idea to do family bingo night, which is a great way to engage the community. So we're working with them to create a countywide PTA event. And our last event is Dr. Damon Bradley, who's a research engineer at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, is visiting us virtually to do a science show. So although the PTA initiated these efforts, we have to give recognition to our Gorman Crossing community for establishing additional activities like scavenger hunts for artwork placed in windows and inspirational sidewalk chalk. Those are the ways that we're continuing to ensure our families stay healthy, and we're just happy to hear what other people are doing and what's going on with you. Thank you.
So let me, I'm sorry, Antoinette. I actually was supposed to answer it afterwards. Let me see if I can open it up for questions right now. And I just want to also say, as we remember, press 0 to get in the queue. It's 6:43 Eastern time, which means that we got 15 minutes for questions, and then we'll have both Nathan and I sum up a little bit in terms of resources that we have, and we'll end at around 7 o'clock. But why don't we start with some questions as I essentially say again that let me just say this. I will on Twitter, so everybody who's not on Twitter now, I want you, it's free, I want you to sign up for Twitter. I will on Twitter after this call tweet all the resources that people have talked about on this call, including the resources that Nathan and I will talk about later from Carnegie, from Share My Lesson. But let's go for the first question. And I want to, again, thank Jim and Antoinette and Dr. Evans and Dr. Cantor and Nathan for doing this work with Carnegie this for this hour. First question.
First up, Randy, we have a question from Channing from Fairfax. This question, I believe, is for Dr. Cantor. Go ahead, Channing, you're live. Channing, are you there?
Dr. Cantor?
Yes.
I am a child from a complex PTSD childhood, and I'm a little bit struggling with how to stay calm during all of this and be supportive of my kids without passing that down on to them. So I was just wondering, based on what you were saying, if you have advice for parents like me. I have two very different kids, one who survives on routine and one who's a complete extrovert and just goes out and does her own thing. Just if you have any advice for someone who's prone to anxiety and depression, how to be there for them, given what you said, it seemed like you have some experience with that. Thank you.
Sure. One of the things that that I spoke about that Dr. Evans emphasized has a good deal to do with you caring for you and you doing things that are responsive to what your health requires. It's a very, very difficult thing to manage a history of PTSD in the atmosphere of things that are going on right now. The things that often do help have to do with calming activities like meditation, journaling, exercise, all kinds of either reflective practice or rhythmic activities are calming to the brain literally at a physiologic level. So that's one thing. The second thing has to do with who calms you. Who is the important relationship in your life that you can count on? So having a short call with such a person or on FaceTime in which you get to speak about the things that you're going through, because I noticed that your questions had a great deal to do with being there for your kids. And the key message here is that you doing a couple of things every day that enable you to achieve calm is the single best thing you can do for them. The second thing I would emphasize would be that whether you have an extroverted child and a child with routines, who likes routines, in this particular time, routines matter. The brain really requires order when there is a lot of chaos outside. So I don't think you should be reluctant to have good, healthy routines in your house. But they can be different for one child than the other. But the routines are really important. So self-care and routines are the two things I would suggest.
Thank you. Next question, Rashid. Rashid, you're still there?
I am. Next up, we have...
Okay, Byron. Next question.
Byron from St. Louis. I believe this question is for one of the doctors. Byron, go ahead. You're live on the air.
Right.
Just wanted you to discuss the importance of Maslow and how we might support parents at home and recognizing the basic needs that need to be covered before we get to critical thinking.
I think that was either for Dr. Evans or Dr. Cantor, but it is one of the reasons why we have pushed very hard to make sure that we have bread and meals and, you know, meals and fighting and stuff like that, and all the resources.
I think that
who would like to take it?
Yeah.
I said,
I would be happy to take it. I think the voices are going in and out, but as I understand the
question,
it is about the hierarchy of needs, looking at things in terms of Maslow's hierarchy, and right at the top is food and shelter. So the experience of creating nutritional safety and safety in shelter is right at the top of the list. Second to that are the self-care qualities that I was just talking about in the last question. But I think you're right to focus on the fact that if we don't pay attention to the primary needs for physical safety as well as emotional safety, it's very, very hard to focus on what you gave as an example, critical thinking, what I would suggest having to do with learning. So shelter, food, self-care, those are the top three.
Thank you, Dr. Cantor. And my apologies, everyone, for my dogs actually wanting barking. Next question, Rashid.
Next up, we have a question from Shante from Maryland. Shante, go ahead. You're live on the air.
My pain to, I guess not so much the anxiety, but just the afterthought of, am I teaching my child the right way? It's one thing to reinforce what the teacher has already taught in school, and then they come home and you reinforce it. But when now everything is just one line and you have to pull it down and try to regurgitate it the best you can, it's a little anxiety, and I have four boys. And so it's just trying to make sure that they're not losing any skills. And I'm just trying to deal with the best way to know how to deal with that.
So, Jim, do you want to take that question, or does one of the doctors want to take it, or Nathan, or...
I can give you a perspective, and then I'll be quick. So to answer your question, for us in Illinois, we basically stopped at the third quarter. And because we, over the 850 districts in our state, 71% of them didn't have the resources for e-learning. So essentially, you know, we have to close that gap. So, you know, whatever you can do for enrichment for your children from this point forward, I have to believe that when school resumes, we're all going to be starting from, you know, the end of third quarter and moving from that position forward. So whatever you can do to engage them in the reading, using video, give them their feedback from that, have them write, practice their reading skills, keep up on that. Those are the things you can do in the meantime. But don't stress about, you know, there's going to be a gap between what we left off and where your children are going to start, because that's going to have to be figured out by the professionals in here and how we're going to manage that. So that's, right now we're kind of in emergency remote learning, but that's the conversation that we're starting to have in terms of when we do go back, what will that look like?
And I just want to make sure, can you guys hear me? I just want to make sure that I reinforce what Jim says. This is a completely different moment in our lives. And we as the education professionals and as the mental health professionals have to do everything we can to help create the kind of well-being that Dr. Cantor and Dr. Evans said first and foremost. It's kind of like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And so one of the things we started thinking about was how do we use the rest of the school year to cap the school year, to kind of sum it up, to kind of reinforce the skills and knowledge that people have, which is why AFT has suggested things like capstone projects and as a way, term projects and capstone projects as a way of doing that. We've also suggested voluntary summer school, if we can be open, for the summer to kind of have the mental health and the nutrition and the instruction to actually prepare for next year. And we also have to fundamentally think about next year as really different than this year. It's a bridge year, and we're going to have to all be in this together. And so most importantly is we got to help engage your kids and help de-stress
everyone in terms of this really, really, really tough year that we're in. Create the continuity and the connection even with the physical distancing.
And just want to ditto everything that Randy just said. And part of why earlier in my talk I emphasized that a calm brain is the prerequisite for learning, especially in a time like this. So the things that you can do to create a household that is fun for the kids and that enables them to feel energy and positivity are things that are going to lead to engagement, and engagement will lead to more learning. A brain that's shut down is not going to get where you want to go anyway.
He was working on trying to catch.
And you know what we...
Look, Randy, you faded out on us.
Sorry, I'm in... we can answer more of your question later on.
We're still having difficulty hearing you, Randy.
I said, let's do a couple more questions. There's a dead zone in my apartment. So you got the dead zone when the dog started barking. Sorry.
Next up, we have a question from Diane Epps. Diane, I think this is a good question for Dr. Evans. Go ahead, Diane.
Thank you. My question is, with younger children in particular, how do we recognize those signs of stress as more than just bickering with their sibling, or teenagers often sleep or are angry and are better able to vocalize? What are we looking for in our kindergarten, first, second graders for these signs of stress that we should be addressing?
Well, you're looking at a variety of things. You're looking at irritability. Is the child very irritable? You mentioned getting into arguments or fights with their siblings would certainly be something. Depending on what the disorder or the condition is, you might see things like bedwetting. You might see clinging behavior, cling to a parent if the child is fearful. You could see disturbances or changes in eating, sleep. So, I mean, parents are pretty good at knowing their children and sort of the routine and their normal, typical behaviors. When you see your child acting in a way that's not consistent with that, it should raise flags. Doesn't necessarily mean something's wrong, but certainly that's one of the first indicators. For children who are a little older, you might see a sudden change in their academic performance, or you might get reports of behavioral problems when you've not had those kinds of reports before. So any sudden change would also be something that you might raise some concerns.
Okay, great. We're seeing all of that, so presume that it would be stress.
Yes. Yep.
So let's do one more question, Rashid, and then Nathan, would you kind of sum up, and then I'll sum up the rest of the call.
Okay. Next, we have a question from Sherry from Florida. Sherry, go ahead. You're live on the call.
Oh, hi. I didn't expect to be live, so let me just grab my question real quick. I think it was Dr. Cantor that spoke about the 2x10 to encourage kids to speak. And so my question around that is, what question do you pose to encourage a child to talk, to open up, in a younger child, elementary age?
Mm-hmm. It can be an activity or it can be a subject, but the prompt is that for 2 minutes a day, we're going to have a special conversation or play a game, just the two of us. And if there are other siblings around, seen as a special thing, just as it would be in a classroom with several kids. It's a very special thing to have that one-on-one time. So the reason this practice works is because it forms that special bond, that relationship bond between you and your child. And if the child is young and being verbal is not the tool you're going to use, then playing a game together for 2 minutes, for 10 days straight. And it's not something you use as an incentive. You never withhold it for a punishment. You do it for 10 days straight, minutes a day, whatever they want to do. That's actually the secret sauce of the practice.
Well, thanks so much for that. Those are all good questions, and I know there are many more that are still there, and I think maybe in the resources that Randy and I share with you, you'll find some of those answers to those questions. I want to thank all of our panelists for giving us language to use to talk about our feelings and our feelings of our children, strategies we can use to reduce our own stress and other issues that we might be facing moving forward. I also want to give a shout out to the AFT and PTA staff and volunteers who made this call possible. And also want to thank again Carnegie Corporation of New York and also Chan Zuckerberg Institute Initiative, who are also helping us with some of the resources we're providing. So I want to share a couple of COVID-19 resources that we have available for you. National PTA launched the dedicated webpage at pta.org/COVID-19 that features resources, tools, and information to support families and educators during the pandemic. There are lots of guides for families on SEL, on learning from home, on healthy habits, resources on learning from home, how to support our students, and how to take care of ourselves. There's also links there to federal resources that provide resources on how to talk to children about COVID-19. There's quite a bit in there on how to learn from home and about the resources that are available that really highlight the homework gap that we all knew existed before this started, but the lack of equal access to technology is certainly becoming more of a challenge. We want to encourage you, if you are interested, to join in and listen to our Notes from the Backpack. It's our podcast on your favorite listening platform. There are COVID-specific episodes there. And so we've also partnered a lot with many partners in the field, AFT being one of our favorites, to deploy resources out to all of you. And so those resources at our dedicated webpage continue to grow, and we invite you to visit there often. You can follow that again at pta.org. There's a banner at the top that will make it easy to click on and find those resources. You can also receive information by following our social media at National PTA and also my own at Nathan Monell. So thank you so much. Thank you, Randy. Thank you, FT. We enjoyed this conversation with everyone.
Thank you, and thank you, National PTA, and thank you, Nathan, and thank you, Dr. Evans, and thank you, Dr. Cantor, and thank you, Antoinette, and thank you, Jim. We've had 55,000 people on this phone call, and I don't know if you heard it, but at 7 o'clock at night in New York City, you hear a huge hoopla all over the place, people going out of their windows to actually say thank you to the healthcare providers. And this is the kind of thing that Dr. Evans and Dr. Cantor were talking about in terms of finding new ways of creating connection even while we have this kind of physical distancing. My wife, by the way, is a rabbi, and we actually do Friday night services right from my apartment, which she Zooms to her whole congregation. But we're finding different ways, and this is part of what we're trying to do, how we create connection, how we become, like one of Jim's students said, the glue in this very, very changed circumstance, a circumstance that all of us will remember for the rest of our lives, just like our grandparents, frankly, in my case, remembered World War II. This will be something that we will all remember, as Dr. Evans said, something we will all get through because of the relationships, the resilience, and the routines, as Dr. Cantor said. And what I would just offer up, and we'll put these in tweets afterwards as well at R. Weingarten, is we also have, Carnegie has resources. I want to thank Carnegie again at carnegie.org/townhall. We have loads of resources at sharemylesson.com,
for parents, for teachers. It's a sharing platform. We have lots of English language learner resources at Coloring Colorado, and we have resources for First Book. We talked before about library books. First Book is a way that we can get resources to people as well. And, of course, in our website, we have resources at aft.org/coronavirus, and we update all of those resources all the time. I'll put them all on Twitter. I just want to actually say at the end, we're all in this, as everyone else has said, we're all in this together. Nobody, we didn't create coronavirus, but we have to be able to help all of us get through it. And that is parents and teachers together engaging in school, helping meet our kids and our own emotional and academic and other needs. So delighted that we are doing all of this together. We'll fight for the money we need for schools. We'll fight for the money that we need for our future. But most importantly, we have to become this kind of community, having each other's back and being socially connected while we are physically distant. Thank you, everybody, for joining us tonight.
Thank you all for having us.
Thank you.